This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. It's week 15. I'm John Engel. You can follow me on Twitter at EngelsEngel. And you can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It'll be in your inbox every Thursday morning. First things first, we are not going to talk about the personal conduct policy and what came down in these last few days because we're not lawyers and we don't deal with that. We do
and neither
on the
are
field.
Our listeners. I mean, why do we, you know, we care so much? It's a PR function, and it has to be because the NFL's a business, and how the fans feel, the perception that the fans have of the league is the reality, and therefore the NFL reacts to that. And that's all I know about it. It's a reactionary thing, and I don't blame them for it.
And I think that's about all we need to hear about that. Now the playoff races are beginning to heat up. A lot of playoff implications throughout our lineup this week. So first we'll get to Cowboys-Eagles. Chip Kelly coming off his worst offensive performance since taking over as the head man in Philly. Only 139 yards of total offense. Andy, what was going on last week for the Eagles?
Well, they ran into a buzzsaw Seahawks defense. And they're the third team in a row that has come away limping away like this. And I wouldn't read too much into it. The one concern, the one takeaway is that Philadelphia's wide receivers struggled to get separation against man coverage. They didn't even get separation against man coverage. Now, that's going to happen against guys like Richard Sherman and Maxwell, who's been sensational. And even Simon on the outside gave Cooper a tough day. I would expect Dallas to play more man coverage based on seeing that and also based on last time when these teams played just 2 weeks ago. The Cowboys got beat in zone. Remember, we worried going into that game that their zone coverages would get exploited out of the trip sets and the crossing patterns?
Yep, exactly.
It's exactly what happened. And Matthews had a big game. Sanchez got comfortable, had mismatches. And I would think the Cowboys will have to take that away, and they'll do what they saw the Seahawks – they'll attempt to do what they saw the Seahawks do last week against this team.
Do they have the ability to do that, though? I think that's the real question.
Yeah, that is the question. I don't think they do. Not like Seattle did it. They're going to have to do – because the other thing is Seattle's defensive line dominated the Eagles' offensive line. And you don't see that Eagles' offensive line get dominated a whole lot. They're not a power group, so they could be susceptible to bull rushers or, you know, the kind of things that look like domination. But as far as lining up snap after snap and beating them to a spot and just outplaying them and out-physicaling them – you don't see that a whole lot, and I don't know if Dallas's defensive line, while it plays with effort and all that kind of stuff, we've talked about the lack of talent that they have on that D-line, and I've said all along, I think that's going to catch up to them at the end of the season. The end of the season is here now, and I think we're starting to see it catch up a little bit.
How about the other side of the ball? The last time these two teams met on Thanksgiving, like we were talking about, the Cowboys had their second lowest production on offense by 1 yard. So it was pretty bad.
Yeah, well, they got garbage yards at the end. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was their worst game of the season.
But the Eagles' defense is often lost in this conversation about Philadelphia. We always look to Chip Kelly, but this defense has shined at a lot of points in this season.
Yeah, I like this defense. I think it's extremely multiple up front. As we've said in recent weeks, they don't blitz as much as people like me had gone in the season thinking they would. But they do a lot of different things out of different formations. And I think there's two, you know, different front looks, I guess, against different formations. There's two guys that really stand out to me up front. That's Connor Barwin.
Of course.
And, yeah, who has the sack numbers. But even take out the sacks, and he'd still be a standout guy. I mean, I almost forget about his sacks because of all the other things he does. It's amazing he has whatever number, 12.5, last I checked. I don't know where he's at now. But it's amazing he has a career-high total in sacks, given that so often he's dropping into coverage or spying a QB or something. So he's one guy. What, you looked it up?
Yeah, he's got 13.5.
Okay, so still a career high. It'll keep being a career high. So he's the one guy, and then Michael Kendricks is the other guy, and his return to the lineup made a noticeable difference for this team. Just football speed. You know, we hear about speed, and what does that mean? I like football speed, where guys play fast and they do everything fast, not just run from point A to point B. Kendricks has great football speed.
Does the success of this defense have anything to do with Chip Kelly, or is this all on defensive coordinator?
It's all on, yeah. I think Chip Kelly would even tell you that. He is a delegator in that sense. Now, the one thing he did do when they first started this thing is he wanted a guy that would run a 3-4 because he, as an offensive coach, Kelly did not like preparing to face 3-4s. So I'm sure they have a little bit of that where Chip Kelly will go into his office, Billy Davis, probably Davis goes into Kelly's office, and he'll say, you know, here's some things that we're not liking, just so you know, maybe we can incorporate some of this kind of thing in there. I mean, good offensive minds are going to think about defense. That's just the nature of them.
On the note of that defense, they are coming off one of their worst games of the year against the Seahawks, allowing 440 yards of total offense for Seattle. Do we see a problem with this defense? They had a lot of trouble containing the run, 188 rushing yards.
How many of those were Russell Wilson's, though? It was something. It was he was in the 60s, I believe, and you're looking it up right now. He was a lot of them were not just Russell Wilson rushing yards, but out of structure rushing yards. And so many of Wilson's completions came out of structure. You got it?
I do. 48 yards, so okay, not
it,
a ton.
It felt like more than that. He ran around a lot and had a lot of dump-off passes. That it was not a fluid type of game, and you don't put that on the defense necessarily. Russell Wilson's a unique guy. I mean, the more I watch him, and we're going to get to him next, I guess, but the more I watch him, the more fascinated I become because he plays the quarterback position in a way nobody else really has, and if that's true, just take that thought. If that's true, then as a defense, how do you prepare for that? And Philadelphia obviously did not do a good job, but, you know, I wouldn't worry about that movement. It's a totally different offense that they're facing this week. And last time they played this offense, they did a wonderful job doubling Dez Bryant with various concepts. A few times they went one-on-one, and he did get him once over the – I think it was Fletcher he beat over the top, but – you'll take that. You'll take one Dez Bryant big play in a game if you're a D coordinator. And then the other thing this defense did is it won in the trenches, just like we talked about their offensive line, I guess, getting beat in the trenches. Well, their defensive line beat the crap out of Dallas' offensive line in that game. And that's been the case every week for a while now. Fletcher Cox is playing extremely well, and he's not the only one. So I would feel good going into this game and finding the Eagles about my chances against the Cowboys as long as they don't get Malcolm Jenkins isolated in man coverage again like we saw last week.
You touched on Wilson just a bit there. You wrote about Kaepernick and Wilson this week in your column, and let's do the same thing as we did in this last comparison. These two teams met on Thanksgiving. What happened in the last one? What might be different here, if anything?
Well, in that game, it was quarterback play, and the negative side of it factored in heavily, and that was influenced by great defense. I mean, that was a defensive slugfest last time, but I bring up the quarterbacks because it's amazing how quickly 49er fans have gotten down on Colin Kaepernick. He used to be a guy you weren't allowed to write anything bad about because the Twitter trolls would pop out of the Bay Area in droves, and that's not happening anymore, and now they're saying we've got to get rid of Kaepernick or what's his deal. His deal's the same deal it's always been. He doesn't read the field well. He's not mechanically sound. And when you put those two things together, you're going to get a chicken with its head cut off at times. Against a good defense like Seattle, that's even more likely to happen. And so that's the one concern. And then as far as Wilson, you know, the reason Russell Wilson, this is what I wrote, the reason Russell Wilson's a drastically better quarterback than Colin Kaepernick is Colin Kaepernick is a quarterback who can move. Russell Wilson is a quarterback who can play on the move, and there's a big difference there because it's like what the Eagles found out. You can't game plan for a lot of the stuff Wilson does. He's going to keep plays alive in a very unique manner, and he'll continue to scan the field. And he's not a great progression passer either, but he can read the field pretty well. And I never thought I'd find a guy where those two things weren't almost one and the same. Progression passing and reading the field, but with Wilson, they're not quite one and the same. Kaepernick, he's scary to game plan for, but you can also manipulate him and get him to do things that you want him to do. He has weaknesses you can exploit.
His speed and ability to run has always been what makes him special, though. We haven't seen that this season. It seems like that's almost gone away.
Because teams are starting to exploit. The more you play, the more your weaknesses become apparent. And that's why the great ones are the pocket passers, where the game's more confined for them, and they're pulling strings from a smaller area rather than just out there naked, so to speak. And so Kaepernick's very vulnerable out there because there's not a lot of structure to his game. And I'm not as big on his running as I used to be. I think he's the fastest QB in the league, and I remember I was the guy that watched the NFL films every run from last year on these QBs, and Kaepernick was by far the most dynamic. And that's true, but I was only watching the run plays. I wasn't watching the plays where they throw off the
breakdown.
Run or they move first. Yeah, I wasn't watching the mobility plays. You can't dial that up at films. There's no way to track that without just watching every single snap. And you know, Kaepernick, it's one thing at a time with him. If he runs, he's only running, and he's only running in one direction. He's not very shifty, and he's not elusive necessarily. He just runs really well. But Russell Wilson's, you could argue he's a much harder guy to tackle because he can make you miss a little bit. He understands angles. And right when you think you got him, if he's behind the line of scrimmage, he's liable to throw. So I have not a Kaepernick guy. I haven't been all along. But even the stuff I liked about him, I'm starting to like a little bit less because I don't think it's certainly not enough to carry the offense the way that people were hoping.
And you said Philadelphia ran into that buzzsaw Seahawks defense. Well, Kaepernick and this 49ers team were the first to run into that buzzsaw defense in this stretch of the last three games. 164 yards of total offense. Do you see a similar output this week? No offensive touchdowns?
That kind of thing, when you get into those kind of extremes, it's always, you know, you don't want to predict that kind of thing. Sure. I mean, it's hard to predict. It's almost like predicting a blocked punt or something like that. But you're asking, will it be domination? Let's look at it this way. What could the Niners do to make it not a dominant defensive performance this time? I think that's how we need to look at it. And I think they need to run the football. Everyone's saying this, and I'm saying it too. They need to run the football more. They're not a spread-out type of offense. They have receivers that theoretically could maybe play in that kind of thing, but those guys are also very well equipped to play in a condensed set of formations. A guy like Anquan Boldin is not someone you put in space. So you don't need to be spreading out and throwing to Anquan Boldin. Use him in other ways and have him out of running formations and keep the base defenses on the field where Kaepernick sees less nickel packages and therefore less disguise. And make it simple and let Frank Gore in that offensive line live or die with them. Don't live or die with your quarterback right now who's not consistent.
No more than 13 attempts for Frank Gore over the last 3 weeks.
Each of the last 3 weeks?
Yep, 13, 10, and 12.
I had no idea it was that. Wow.
10 attempts against Seattle last time.
Because all year long, it's felt like every time we've said they don't run the ball, they come out and they run the ball the next game. But that's a three-game stretch now. That's a body of work. That's a sample size. I'm surprised. And I know also watching the Niners film last week, it wasn't, you know, against the Raiders. And the Raiders outplayed them in that game, by the way. It wasn't also just the Niners didn't play well. The Raiders outplayed them. So credit to the Raiders. But there wasn't a rhythmic approach to the run game either. Those attempts that Frank Gore is getting are not coming in bunches. They're not coming in within the structure of the offense. They're just one individual play after another. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it seems like there's no functionality to this offense at all over the last 3-4 weeks.
And people are getting down on Greg Roman and Jim Harbaugh for that, but keep in mind, what are they supposed to do? Their quarterback right now is a little bit rudderless. And when your quarterback's rudderless, I guess the only thing they could do, and maybe this is where the criticism could be fair, and I like Greg Roman. I think he's one of the smartest football minds you'll ever encounter. And he's a great designer of game plans, and he thinks the game. But maybe where you could criticize those guys is that they haven't done enough to try to bring Kaepernick back into his comfort zone. But, you know, even as I say that, I'm thinking in my mind, like the first play of the Raider game last week where he throws that interception, the play was for a little dump off to the fullback in the flat. That was the play design. And you could tell because they did a chip or a cut block with Frank Gore on a defensive end. You don't put your running back on a defensive end to block him, especially where the running back just goes to the ground, unless you're planning on the quarterback dumping it off right away. Because otherwise, the defensive end's going to go sack your quarterback. Well, Kaepernick didn't dump it off right away. He ran around, again, chicken with the head cut off, and then threw an inaccurate pass off balance that was intercepted. What is the coach supposed to do there? I mean, I don't fathom how you call a dump-off pass for a fullback and have that turn into what it turned into. How is the execution that off? And I don't know the answer to that. Nobody does without being inside the organization. So I'm speaking in circles here. I don't think you can blame the coaches. You know, maybe they just call more dump off passes. I don't know what they're
I think it's
do.
Obvious that Kaepernick's a bit lost out there. Two quarterbacks that are rarely lost.
Never seen him lost.
Philip Rivers is hosting Peyton Manning this week. It's a great week for playoff implications and division rivalries. Broncos at Chargers, and the division is Denver's to have at this point. San Diego is still the front runner in the wild card race now. This is the fifth time since November 10th of last year that these two teams have played. That's phenomenal. 3-1 for the Broncos in the series coming in. What are you looking for in this game?
I'm looking for how San Diego approaches Peyton Manning. They played a lot of man coverage when these teams met on a Thursday night. I believe that was back in week 8. And it did not work out for them. As, you know, they could listen to the show and we would have told them, right? Denver's a hard team to play man coverage against. But the other part is Denver's a hard team to play zone coverage against, too. I think you have to play zone, and it has to be an unpredictable type of zone. You can't line up and just play. We've talked about this as well. Can't play cover two against Manning. You have to give them different looks. And San Diego is equipped to do that.
Were you surprised at all to see John Pagano almost exclusively put Eric Weddle on Gronkowski last week? That was pretty incredible, seeing little Weddle running around with the freak of nature that is Rob Gronkowski.
I guess a little bit, but I don't know who else they would put on Gronkowski. That's not a very deep, in fact, it's a thin secondary.
Wasn't given help either. I thought that was the most miraculous thing, is you're seeing them in the red zone and Gronk is just with Weddle and he's holding his own.
Yeah, Weddle's holding his own, yeah. That might be why they chose Weddle. I mean, Weddle's a type of player, if there's any help at all, because a lot of times, guys, the idea of a guy playing with no help, that's very rarely does it truly come down to no help, because there's usually eyes on a quarterback coming from somewhere. And if a defensive back understands how those eyes relate to him, if they understand that, hey, I've got maybe, and it doesn't work this way, but I have 10% help over here or something like that, then the great ones, the smart ones, will play to that. And Weddle is one of those kind of guys. So I would guess he got to do a lot of that in that game. But I think we're going to see Weddle again. Now I'm wondering, see, another reason I think you don't want to do man coverage is because then you're using Weddle this way again a second week in a row, because who guards Julius Thomas if you go man coverage? And I think Thomas will be back in the lineup this week.
Well, and Julius Thomas is used a lot differently than Gronkowski, too. Gronkowski is often put out almost in a wide receiver role.
Well, but Julius Thomas, John, he does that a lot. Thomas does that. In fact, I would say Thomas might even do that. We don't quite notice it as much because there's Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders. There's actual wide receivers on that team versus New England that's got these unique kind of wide receivers and none of them are one-on-one mismatches. But Julius Thomas is a guy they put out a lot, and they don't throw the ball to him out when he's split out as much as New England might be apt to throw to Gronkowski. But Adam Gase, our offensive coordinator, still loves to dictate matchups with Julius Thomas out there. And we could get into, there's a whole slew of things that happens when you put your tight end out wide. And one of them, the simplest one, and the one I'm sure Manning likes, is if you put your tight end out wide as a wide receiver, you almost always will get to a zone or man coverage indicator. Because if a cornerback stays out in his usual spot against a tight end, you know it's zone, because they would not put a cornerback on a tight end in man-to-man, because there leaves a mismatch on a wide receiver somewhere. If someone like Eric Weddle were to follow Julius Thomas out wide, then you know it is man-to-man, because they're not going to play a safety at cornerback for no reason. So that's the value of these kind of tight ends in today's game. And that's why, you know, look at some of the smartest QBs in the league. It's no coincidence they also are the guys with these kind of tight ends. Breeze and Jimmy Graham, Gronkowski and Brady, Manning and Julius Thomas. I mean, and even Kobe Fleener and Andrew Luck. I mean, it's these guys, and the Packers use Andrew Corliss this way too, especially in the red zone. So there's a lot they can do, and I think that Julius Thomas will be key in this game for these reasons, because it's going to be a chess match, and Eric Weddle's going to be moving around and showing disguises before the snap, and he's been a trouble for Manning in the past. Not big trouble, but he's been a thorn in the side, and Denver's going to combat that. It's going to be a good matchup there.
With Julius Thomas out those last couple of weeks, we've seen Denver go towards the run a lot more often. Do you see that being consistent as we head closer to the playoffs and into the playoffs? Does Denver stick with this?
John, you're the first person to point out that it's Julius Thomas being out and the running game increasing. You know, Denver
has a visionary, man.
Well, it's people had no one's mentioned that it's that their uber athletic tight ends out of the lineup, and all of a sudden they're running the ball a lot. I'm curious to see if they keep running the ball, and they might. I'm sure they'll be more balanced than they were in that St. Louis game, and as they were getting, you know, way unbalanced for a while. But you're right. They were doing 6 offensive linemen and Virgil Green, a blocking tight end, because their main guy's out. I don't know if they're going to stick with it or not. I know Adam Gase does not like to run the ball. He's a passing game guy, but he's also, you know, his quarterback and him, they like to win as well, and winning right now is coming through the run game.
Is Julius Thomas typically a first look for Peyton Manning? Because it seemed like in those first 10 weeks or so that it was always the flow of the offense always went through Julius Thomas. Is that not
I think that's just how it seemed. I don't think it works that way, not with that offense, because they've got viable receivers at every spot, and the first looks almost always based on what the coverage is.
While we're on it, let's round out the AFC West. Oakland is at Arrowhead this week, and the Raiders are coming off that second win of the season and the upset win over the 49ers like we talked about. Their first win was a win over the Chiefs. Real quick, what do you think about the Raiders overall? Are this some positive points here?
Can I'm more encouraged by them this week.
Build up some Raiders fans?
Yeah, this week they look better than they did last week, certainly. And that St. Louis game, that's a throw-the-tape-out game. Those things happen in the NFL. And as the Raiders, it looks real bad when it happens to you because you're the Raiders and you haven't had a lot of success. And so, you know, the image there. But if I'm a Raiders fan, I'm very encouraged because Derek Carr, I think he is. I wrote this was the main thing this week. I wrote that I think he is the guy. I think he's certainly worth a very long look as a franchise QB for them. And they've got some other pieces on defense in the right spot.
With these wins, Oakland has a much slimmer chance of getting that first overall pick. But you don't think they should go with Mariota if they were to get that pick?
No, I don't think they should go with a quarterback at all. I think Derek Carr is the guy, or at least he's worth a long look. It'd be a travesty to just cast, I don't know what you do with him, for one, what you cast aside Derek Carr. Derek Carr should be an NFL starting QB.
What I love that you wrote about, too, is you mentioned the mobility. We've been hard on quarterback mobility and footwork in the pocket, and you see that in Derek Carr.
It's functional mobility. It's that Philip Rivers type of mobility. And he keeps his eyes where his feet are working as well. And so he's willing to do that. And keeping your eyes and your feet synced, that's where good mechanics come from. And when your feet and your eyes are on two different pages, that's where bad mechanics come from. And Carr, we've seen some bouts of bad mechanics. But I think that's aberrational. I think it's a rookie learning to play on the fly. The fact that he's willing to keep his feet and his eyes locked up, the fact that he knows how, and he does it under duress with almost regularity. I mean, we've seen this a lot now. I think he's going to be a very sharp, mechanically sound passer overall. I'm not at all worried about him there.
For the Chiefs, 7-6 now. They play two wild card leaders, Pittsburgh and San Diego, in week 16 and 17, and they've beaten two 7-6 teams in the Bills and Dolphins. A win here really puts them in position to control their destiny, which no one's really talking about.
Yeah, I think the Chiefs are not at the forefront of people's minds for the playoff race, and I don't know how the math shakes out. You know, it certainly looks good for them, and obviously this is a game that they're going to want very badly, although I don't know if you could necessarily call it a must win. Whatever, it doesn't matter. The Chiefs have to get on track here. And we know how that goes for the Chiefs, right? It's about Jamal Charles in the running game. You have to get Travis and Kelce involved in the passing game. And, oh, remember last week I was telling you that they were going to attack Arizona's guards with their Justin Houston, Tom Mahaly, and all
right.
Yeah. I heard they did that. I've read some NFL film notes from someone that indicated they did. I haven't seen the film myself yet. I'll watch it soon.
Well,
but
I'll give you a Justin tidbit. Justin Houston was incredible.
Was he?
Yeah, he was great.
I heard he came from defensive tackle alignment quite often in that. And Arizona did have some backup guards in there. So how about this? Will they do that this week against Oakland? Because it's Steve Wisniewski. Gabe Jackson's now starting at left guard for him. And at right guard would be – who is their right guard? I'm blanking on his name in the moment. Austin Howard. Howard, that's right. Yeah, blank. He's a tackle. It's confusing because he's a former right tackle. Khalif Barnes is now at right tackle, and he played guard. It's a lot of flip-flopping there. But I think we'll see Kansas City attack those Oakland guys a little, especially Austin Howard and Barnes on that side if he's in over Menelik Watson, because Howard's a guy you want to get him moving left and right. He's a big guy. He's a mauler, so to speak. And a mauler is not equipped to block a guy like Justin Houston in space. So
last week, Houston had a pair of sacks. So
yep, widen the passing lanes, pass rushing lanes inside, maybe do some stunts or something, get Houston attacking them. By the way, this Oakland, you know, I'm talking about Oakland and how to beat them in pass pro. No one's really figured out how to do that. My guy, Ryan Lacy, one of my fact checkers, pointed this out to me. Derek Carr is third in average sacks per dropback, only behind Manning and Brady. And Oakland's offensive line, and I like that stat because it agrees with what I've been taking notes on film and how the Raiders have looked on film. Oakland's offensive line is one of the best in the league in pass protection. They're not very good run blocking, which you'd think they would be because they have several Austin Howard-type guys. But they're actually very, very good in pass pro, and Donald Penn's had a good season at left tackle for him. It's a big reason why.
For someone who's not a Raiders fan, though, I think the initial thought has to be, oh, the line's bad. Oh, there's a bad offensive line. That's why they struggle. But I guess that's not true.
Yeah, and I knew they struggled in the run game, and I looked up their pass game. I just Googled, you know, I word searched my notes, and almost every note was positive about pass protection in multiple games. They've had some really good pass protection games this year.
Another AFC division rivalry taking place back east, Dolphins at Patriots. Darrelle Revis has been unbelievable lately. Do you expect him to stay on Mike Wallace, or is this more
of a Jarvis Landry? Else. Yeah, I think it's going to be Landry. Remember last year they had Aqib Talib, who I think, if you were to like craft or you know mold a cornerback equipped to take on a Mike Wallace, I think you'd get Aqib Talib out of it. Long arm guy, lanky, can run, can backpedal. And they did not put a Talib on Mike Wallace. They didn't even think about it, really. Talib guarded almost everybody but Mike Wallace. He even guarded Charles Clay multiple times. That won't happen. They're not going to put Revis on Clay this week because it's a different system. Clay's not the same guy in the new offense or whatever it is this year. Clay's not the same guy. Landry's the most dangerous receiver there. And if you take him away, you also are more likely to win in the middle of the field and force Tannehill to play on the perimeter. And I think Brandon Browner is an excellent matchup favoring the Patriots against Mike Wallace. I don't see Mike Wallace – I don't see him responding with great alacrity against the physicality of Brandon Browner.
Last week he only had 39 receiving yards against the Ravens, a secondary that's been tumultuous lately, especially with injuries.
But Miami couldn't take advantage of that secondary. It's too bad. Their offensive tackle situation is really hurting them right now, and that was the case. It's against Baltimore, and New England's not known for its pass rush, but it might show up that Rob Ninkovich might have a big game because he'll be going up against Dallas Thomas, who's a guard that's being forced to play tackle due to injuries, and he's struggling right now. He's going to struggle whenever he's at right tackle. He's not a right tackle.
On the other side of the ball, are you buying LeGarrette Blount as a featured back for the Patriots, or is this just a temporary Band-Aid for them as they head into the playoffs?
I don't know. I think it's a function of every time. Look, I've never been a Blount believer, but I can't argue with what he's doing this year. I mean, he is hard to tackle.
He's huge.
And he was – when he first came in the league, everybody assumed that he would be hard to tackle because he was huge back then as well. And he actually was quite easy to tackle. He had no power. He ran upright. He stopped his feet on contact, and he wasn't imaginative at all. He was a very bad runner. He happened to get a lot of yards in Tampa Bay one year, and he had a few chunk plays that I think inflated his numbers. But
and his highlight reel hurdles.
Yeah, and those look good, and he looks like he's a lot more athletic than he is. He's a guy that can occasionally jump. I get it. But they got rid of him in Tampa Bay. They didn't even think about holding on to him. And he came in undrafted, and I know he had character issues, but there have been plenty of guys with character issues like his that still got drafted. LeGarrette Blount was not the most gifted runner. I keep thinking that's got to hold true, right? Because look how his body's built. Why would it change? Runners don't change much with age. It's one position where that you don't see that very often, almost never. But with him, it has changed. He is hard to tackle now. Guys do bounce off of him. He doesn't stop his feet on contact anymore. He lowers the shoulder. He's turned in. I commend LeGarrette Blount. He's turned into a good, solid runner. Now, it sounds like he's still a pain in the ass to deal with, which is why he's in New England and not Pittsburgh. But, you know, 4 out of 5 improvements aren't bad, I guess, right? It worked out well for him. I don't know if they'll start him throughout the playoffs, though, because Shane Vereen's a totally different type of back. And even Jonas Gray is a little bit of a different type of back, more similar than not. But I could see them deciding that this week those guys match up best and we're going to go there. Now, I don't know, Miami, maybe I don't think they'll probably keep Blunden against Miami. But you asked about the big picture.
Okay, more division rivalries. Texans at Colts. Andy, you're our supreme worshiper of Andrew Luck.
That's hardly fair.
That's the truth. Would you give him the MVP if you had to choose over a J.J. Watt?
So it's Luck versus
or
Watt.
The only options.
I think every listener of ours right now would instinctively say Watt because we've heard Watt be in the discussion all season long. And Andrew Luck really has not, saved for maybe a few weeks ago. Although in almost any other year, Andrew Luck would be in the discussion. I mean, he's carrying the Colts right now. His numbers are top of the league. But Brady and Manning and Rivers and especially Rodgers are all having their best season, so Luck gets a little bit overlooked.
That's where I was going to go, the separation at position. I mean, J.J. Watt is so far away,
right, great point,
the top, and there's a big gap for number two. But with Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, I mean, it's hard to just even look at Andrew Luck right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Here's my argument. That doesn't make you an MVP. I mean, Shane Leckler for a long time and Andy Lee were the best punters in the world by a wide margin. You don't crown them. And I know you're not. I know that's extreme. You're not asking that. But my point is a quarterback, if we're going by the definition of most valuable player, I got in this argument with Mike Tannier and Mike Tannier's with Bleacher Report now, and he's excellent, a great writer. And Doug Farrar, who's one of our guys at SI, he was at Yahoo at the time. I got in this argument in New Orleans a few years ago, the Super Bowl, big-time argument, saying they said I was making the point, you know, the quarterbacks touch the ball every play. The game goes through them. The game plans are designed around them. By definition, most valuable, then it's them. And they said, well, what are you saying, that you can only crown a quarterback MVP? And I said, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I don't think any other position should be in consideration for MVP. We need to, if you don't like that, then invent some other awards or something, or put the eggs in other baskets and make other, like, offensive and defensive player of the year more prestigious. But if we're talking most valuable player, the nature of football, the eight most valuable players in the league are all quarterbacks this year. J.J. Watt might be ninth or something like that.
Do you think the Texans going with J.J. Watt in these goal line offensive sets is trying to get him the MVP, or
is it necessary
for the offense? That's what I want to know.
Okay, and yeah, you're asking this.
It feels like award hunting to me.
No,
when I see him
not.
Go out there, I'm John. Like, oh, come on.
No, the Texans are in the wild card chase. They're not, and J.J. Watt is even saying he's not going to stump for votes. They're not doing. No, I 100,000% guarantee you, it's not a gimmick. It's not award hunting.
What will the Colts do this week to combat the J.J. Watt machine?
Well, they faced that machine once, and that was, I think, the Week 5 game on Thursday night, 33-28, if I recall. And it was, they built the big lead in Indy, and then Houston came back. J.J. Watt made some tremendous plays, including a fumble recovery touchdown on that one, and he was, you know, I don't think they're going to do anything to combat this. I mean,
what can you do?
With a seven offensive lineman set and have two of them come out of the backfield or something? You already kind of have that in Trent Richardson anyway, I guess. There's no answer for it. Now, they're not going to let Watt kill them, but they have to understand he's going to make a few plays, and it's on Andrew Luck when this happens to not turn the ball over. And he's done a very bad job of that lately. Against Cleveland, that end zone fumble that he had that I think Kruger recovered, maybe Kruger hit him. Someone,
I think it was.
Yeah, we all know the play I'm talking about. That was as bad as a quarterback play can get. You can't. He's trying to make a play on 3rd and 10 there as a dump off pass when he's in the grasp. The best case scenario is they gain 4 yards and punt on 4th and 6. The worst case is what happened to him. You cannot even contemplate those kind of plays if you're Andrew Luck facing J.J. Watt. You have to minimize the damage on his great plays. And I would say, well, you get the ball out quickly or something like that, but he'll swat it down. There's not a lot of ways to get around J.J. Watt.
So but you're saying he's pretty valuable. That's what it sounds like.
But he's not taking every single snap, though. And he's not making – you know, he can't score. I know he can't score. I hate to say that.
He can score.
Well,
tight end, man.
Okay, he has 3 touchdowns on the year. Is that the most valuable player?
Well, he's playing both sides of the ball. This isn't 7-on-7 high school ball out in, you know, the boonies. But it looks like the NFL is doing this on purpose. Another division rivalry on our hands, Bengals and Browns. Last time these two teams met, Brian Hoyer played well. It was one of his better games.
It was his last good game.
Yeah, that's right. This week, Mike Pettine has decided to go with Johnny Manziel.
Yep, it's right call.
You thought he would make last week.
Yeah, I was very sure he was going to make that last week.
You almost wrote an entire article on it before it happened.
Or maybe I did, and I had to rewrite the article, and the editors were patient with me. Thanks for sharing that,
You're
John.
Welcome.
I watched the Colts game, and I think I've seen every Browns game this year. And Hoyer's gotten progressively worse. And this tend, like we said, who was it? Kaepernick we're talking about, where this tends to happen, that the more they see you, the more your weaknesses become exploited. I call that the Tommy Maddox syndrome. Remember a few years ago, Tommy Maddox, well, it was more than a few, it was 10 or 12, but he came in pre-Roethlisberger. He came in for Pittsburgh, and lit the world on fire, and I think he got a new contract or something after that. But he only played 8 games. Derek Anderson for the Browns did the same thing in 2007, I think it was. And they only play 8 games, and then everyone thinks, oh, you got a QB here. There's something that happens after 8 games. I don't know what it is, but after 8 games, teams start to see your warts. And I think that happened a little bit with Brian Hoyer. I also think he just didn't play as well.
Johnny Manziel is never going to be your prototypical pocket passer. Do you see the Browns needing to develop ways to get him in these unstructured plays to make him successful? Almost on the lines of, I don't want to even compare him to Russell Wilson, but
well, he's going to have
the lines kind of way.
He's going to have to be that in order to succeed in the NFL. So you're not comparing him to Wilson, but that's the path they're going to try to put him on, and that's a tall order. They're a little bit set up for that already. In fact, the reason early in the year I was sure that Hoyer would get, and this was before I saw him play well the first few weeks, but heading into the season, I was sure that Hoyer would be benched relatively soon, especially after seeing week one and week two, where their offense seemed already ready for Johnny Manziel, designed for him, rollouts, bootlegs, moving pockets, which he's going to need because he can't, just like Russell Wilson, he can't necessarily see over the line very easily. I think we'll see a lot more of that. And for whatever reason, I don't know if maybe it's something to do with Josh Gordon coming back, but the Browns have gotten away from that the last few weeks. And that might be part of the reason Hoyer did not play as well. And I'm not criticizing the play calling at all. I mean, I say for whatever reason, I know there are reasons, and I hope to meet Shanahan in the offseason and get to ask him that. But they're not going to get away with it away from it with Manziel. They'll return to some of those zone stretch play action concepts with him.
What's been crazy is that the 3 games that Hoyer has had his best offensive asset on the field have been 3 of his worst. They're
I know, isn't that weird? And I wondered about that too. It's like sometimes, like, it's remember Patrick Ewing with the Knicks, and whenever he went out, they were somehow better. It's what Bill Simmons calls the Ewing theory, I think it is.
Yeah.
Ewing. Yeah. And I think that can be true in basketball, where there's only 5 players and the dynamic is so tightly wound between player to player because of the nature of the sport. I don't know if it's true in football, and especially with a wide receiver, unless you change your play calling, which in that case, that's your fault. That's not the wide receiver's fault. And they've changed things a little bit. They do some stuff to try to get Gordon the ball, but if they weren't doing that, we'd be sitting here saying, what in the world's wrong with them? Why are they not getting their best player the ball? So I don't know if – I think I chalk it up to a coincidence, but I do find that bizarre that they fell on their face when Gordon came back. I didn't see that coming at all.
Steelers-Falcons this week as well. Great campaign this season by Le'Veon Bell, which is kind of overshadowed by what DeMarco Murray has been able to do in Dallas. Is Le'Veon Bell the better back overall? Is he the best back in the NFL?
Yes, and I don't think there's any hesitation about it. And let me go a step further. He's the better runner overall too. And here come the tweets. I can already feel them, and I know because I already tweeted this earlier in the week, and I got tweets back about it, saying you can't say that. You know the numbers are so skewed. Offensive line, man. It's offense. Dallas is a great offensive line. It's the old Emmitt Smith debate, and I hate to say that too because I was an Emmitt Smith apologist as a little kid. But it's the old Emmitt Smith debate where how much of it's the running back, how much of it's the offensive line. Just putting them in isolation, and no one would argue that Murray's a better runner than Bell. They just wouldn't. Bell can do more things.
You mean Bell than Murray?
I would say no one would argue that Murray's better than Bell.
Oh, gotcha.
In isolation,
gotcha.
Yeah. Now, if you factor in the sheer power of, where you're running guys over, then the gap narrows a little bit, but there's still a gap between them. Bell's a much better runner. He's more agile. He's more explosive. He's great with his patience and what he does off of his patience. He sees the field well. And then when you factor in the receiving aspect of it, Le'Veon Bell, he is a legit – now, there's another MVP candidate who's not a quarterback, a very legit one. He's not going to get it, and I hope they don't give it to him. But, it's he's first-team all-pro running back, in my opinion.
When you look at Bell and the way he runs, it seems like he's so shifty that he's a smaller back, but he's huge. He's big, 230 pounds.
And he lost 15 of those pounds in the offseason, which
amazing.
You can tell. You can see the difference on him, too. He was not – he looked like a quick, shifty guy that wasn't very quick and shifty as a rookie. He looked like a heavy-set, quick and shifty guy or something like that. And now
LeGarrette Blount with agility.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Strong maybe. Yeah. But LeGarrette Blount can't catch a ball if you throw it to him 2 yards away, if you toss it to him. And Le'Veon Bell can catch. I mean, he can run wide receiver type routes as well.
What do you make about the Steelers this week, one of the more inconsistent teams throughout the year?
Yeah, well, let's see. It comes down to whether we decide Atlanta's a good team or a bad team, because that'll determine how well Pittsburgh plays, it seems like, right?
I'm going to go with bad.
If you think they're a bad team, then Pittsburgh's going to have a bad game. That's what it is. I don't know if I'd call Atlanta a bad team.
Well, after watching that game against the Packers, I think it's a little deceiving, because Julio Jones is impossible to cover for anyone, and he had a big game.
Yeah, Packers didn't play great either at times. But Pittsburgh's secondary is playing much worse than Green Bay's secondary has played at any point this year right now.
So Steelers going into this game, you don't expect good things? Atlanta 21st against the run?
I'm a little
stick with Le'Veon. Let him take
you
to the
promised land. Yeah, I'm tongue-in-cheek when I say that you know, you can't predict. I think they do play down to their competition. There's no debating that, given how their record's shooken out this year. But you can't predict that they're going to play down to their competition.
You led us perfectly into Packers-Bills. Last week we had Jerry Hughes on the show. This week we'll have a man who on occasion will have to deal with those Buffalo twists and stunts and a great defensive line. He'll be blocking Jerry Hughes at times. That's Packers left guard Josh Sitton. Before we run into this interview, Andy, what about the Packers offensive line? Hasn't gotten them much publicity this season. They've been good.
Yeah, they have been good. I think they're getting a little bit more now, because we're seeing Rodgers drop back, and on some plays he has 8 to 12 seconds to throw.
Riding the bowl.
Yeah, 8 to 12 seconds to throw. And he's not running around when he does that. That's in the pocket. They've had some amazing pass protection sequences this year, to the point where they're in that, you know, right up there with, I think they're a little ahead of Oakland. And I think they're in that discussion of who are the best pass blocking offensive lines in the league. I'd give it to Dallas overall, but I think Green Bay is starting to catch him, which is amazing, because it's the same guys, same personnel who a few years ago couldn't block to save their lives.
And giving Aaron Rodgers that kind of time is like a sniper with no wind, you know? It's scary. Yeah.
It is. And I don't mean to say couldn't block to save their lives. That's harsh. That's too harsh, especially to the guy that I talked to this week, Sitton, who I think's been a Pro Bowl caliber guy for several years. But it was a very young offensive line, even at this time last year. And it's been a revolving door, and they've had very bad struggles at times. And this year they have not had the struggles, and they've flourished. I mean, it's quite impressive. And, you know, this will be their biggest test so far this season.
Okay, well, let's get right to it. Josh Sitton with Andy Benoit.
We're talking with Josh Sitton of the Green Bay Packers, still probably the most underrated guard in football, amazingly, after so many years of being the most underrated guard. Josh, appreciate you being here with us. And we often hear about offensive linemen, how they don't necessarily like to have their quarterbacks running around and making plays, quote-unquote. As blockers, you don't know where the guy's going to be. It seems like things are a little different in Green Bay. Your guy tends to make several plays, and it seems to work out for the offense. Why are things in this regard different with Aaron Rodgers and blocking for Aaron Rodgers?
Well, I mean, he's just he's the best in the business at moving around. He's got an unbelievable feel for the pocket, and, you know, even when he can't see guys, he can feel them and just know where they're going to be, and he's just the best at doing it. I mean, sometimes it screws your block up, but, you know, we get big plays off it more often than not, so we'll definitely take it.
Is it something you guys practice? Can you practice that kind of thing when the game becomes almost sandlot like that?
Well, if there's a play at practice, you know, let's say a lineman gets beat or whatever and it's a clear sack, well, we don't ever stop. You know, so the whole team is taught to do the scramble drill. So, you know, it works with the defense, so they have to keep covering, and it helps Aaron and the offense work on our scramble drill as well.
Something you guys do in Green Bay in the running game, and especially with Eddie Lacy, is tosses to get the ball in the running back's hands quicker versus handoffs, versus handoffs. Does that, with the tosses, does that change your approach as a run blocker in any way?
Yeah, it can. Usually when the ball is tossed, the linebackers are going to play to whatever that side is a little bit faster. So you have to be ready for a linebacker to play downhill or outside quicker. So it's definitely something that we like to know as offensive lineman if it's going to be tossed or not, because it definitely affects your block.
Something that gets linebackers playing a little slower at times would be screen passes, and Lacy's had some big ones this year, and you've been a big part of several of those big screens. What's the key to executing screens in general? If you had to teach a listener, hey, in three sentences or something, here's how a guard blocks the screenplay successfully.
Well, it's all about making the defensive lineman think it's a pass, and then second to that is timing. Your timing has to be perfect. Early in the year, we weren't having as much success. Our timing was a little off, and we weren't running screens a lot. So as the year has gone on, the timing has got better, and we've been very successful as of late. So it'll hopefully continue to go that way. But the biggest thing is timing. And what I mean by that is your offensive lineman has to get out just a split second before the running back, and that has to mesh up pretty good.
It seems like you guys, especially last year, like to do these screen plays once you get inside around, say, the opponent's 30-yard line or so. Is that true? And if it is, why is that the case?
I don't know. I think it's game plan. I don't really know. I just run what's called, so. I think it's pretty game plan specific. Each week it's kind of different. Teams have tendencies. And if we get a tendency and the screen looks good, then, that's the yard line we'll run it on.
In the passing game, and especially third down passing situations, more and more teams across the league, we're seeing them do these cultivated multi-dimensional pass rush concepts, double A gap, especially mainly out of the nickel and dime sub packages. For the longest time, all of the other NFC North teams that you were facing did not do this stuff. They were straight zone-based type defenses, straight four-man rushes, maybe some PE stunts, but nothing super creative. As an offensive lineman, I know things have now changed a little bit with Detroit and especially Minnesota, but conceptually, throughout your career, facing these four-man rushes, as a lineman, which do you prefer, to face those convoluted pass rush designs where you have to study a lot during the week, or to face the more traditional straight pass rushes where the guys that are executing them are very good at their technique?
I probably would say that I would like going against anytime they're doing a blitz or something like that. I like that better. I'm good at seeing that. It can make it a little bit harder on the quarterback, but if you're talking strictly just me, in a selfish way, I would say I like going against blitz. When they're moving around, they're not, going forward, so it makes it a little bit easier for you.
And I assume also you get matched up at times on guys that aren't necessarily bona fide pass rushers. You're not seeing Ndamukong Suh come from the linebacker position very often on a blitz. It's more likely to be a pass or a linebacker for him.
Yeah, I'd rather block a linebacker than a D-tackle, for sure.
Last question I have for you, I'll get you on here, and this is something Greg Bedard and I have debated a lot on MMQB, I guess not on the site, but off to the side. What's harder, in your opinion, to execute, a pull block on a man-blocking concept or a reach and steal block in a zone play?
For me, I would say a reach block is like something that have been very good at left guard. I feel like that's kind of one of my strengths at left guard. If I was a right guard, I would say the pull block would be easier, but at left guard, it's the reach block for me.
Why would the right guard, why the difference with the right guard?
I'm just better at going left for some reason, whatever reason it is. I don't know why, but I'm better at going left than I was going right.
Good stuff from Josh Sitton. We'll jump right into Minnesota Vikings on the road against the Detroit Lions. Mike Zimmer coming out and saying this is Teddy's team.
Doesn't hurt him to say that, and it might hurt him to not say it. So
I guess
that's all
the
you
right
need
decision.
To know. That's
61% completion percentage, 10 touchdowns, 8 picks. Not terrible numbers for Teddy.
Highly controlled guy. So I have trouble saying it's his team, because if it's his team, then open up the offense for him.
Who we know it isn't his team. Cordarrelle Patterson has just been completely eliminated from this offense.
Yeah, and I get it. I understand why. I'm shocked. I mean, if you told me before the year that Cordarrelle Patterson would I think he had a did not play, or he played three snaps in
5 receptions over the last 5 weeks.
Okay, and I don't know his snap total from the most recent game, which is the overtime win the Jets, but I know the one before that, he played like 3 snaps, I think it was. This Charles Johnson guy understands the offense better, that's clear. He's pretty sound and stuff. He has a good frame. He can be a possession target if you need him to be, which Patterson does not offer. Charles Johnson also stretches the field okay when given the right route against the right coverage. And with Norv Turner, you often do get the right route against the right coverage.
Last week, he didn't have a single target.
Who, Patterson?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
One rush, six yards.
He's fallen off. And that's another thing. Thanks for saying that, because the rushing, why I was surprised he hasn't gotten the ball in that regard more. He had that sweep that he had for a touchdown last year. I think it was a sweep, but it was, I forget who they were playing.
Well, they did that against St. Louis in week one, too. He had 102 rushing yards.
Okay, that might be what I remember. But and towards the end of last year, he had some great running plays as well. I'm surprised they haven't incorporated that into the offense more. Patterson has a skill set you can use. They better not be giving up on him right now. And I kind of understand why they've moved on. They certainly know more about moved on for this year. They know more about Patterson than I do. I'm not in that building with him. He's probably not getting the game plans, not grasping them the way they want, and Charles Johnson is, and they're doing that. The other thing to keep in mind, when you run a limited offense like they do to accommodate Bridgewater, and he reads the field well. I'm not trying to downplay Teddy Bridgewater here. But they're easing him into the league, as they should. That's good coaching with a rookie QB. But when you do that, you don't necessarily ask the same things out of your receivers that you normally would. You might be throwing a little bit more out of other sets. You're doing, some quick pass stuff, but you would think Patterson would be a part of the quick pass plans. Patterson's worth looking at for next year. Don't write him off now, but it's been a bad season for him, no question.
On the other side of the ball, this Vikings secondary is also not one to write off, and they held Detroit to under 300 yards, or that whole defense held Detroit to under 300 yards the last time they met. It's a good secondary, and who knows what we're going to get out of Matthew Stafford this week.
Yeah, the Vikings had some success in man coverage against this team when they met back in week 6. That was a game Calvin Johnson sat out, though, with that ankle injury. I would expect, that changes things too. You don't necessarily play man-to-man again because now Calvin Johnson is in the lineup. But I would expect they would return to some of that a little bit, because you also get into your pressure concepts out of that. And something Minnesota did that I really liked the last time these teams played, they brought pressure on early downs. As the game progressed, they did that. And I would think that was in response to Detroit was having a lot of success, or at least they were doing a lot of attempts of play action on first down. And pressure versus play action, usually pressure will win that battle. And so maybe we'll see some of that. I'd like to see Zimmer get into some of his Zimmer stuff early in the down and maybe try to dictate the flow of the game in that regard. But if they want to just sit back and play coverage, I wouldn't fault them for that either, because their secondary, like you said, John, it is playing extremely well. I'd be real thrilled with two guys, Xavier Rhodes and Harrison Smith, if I were them.
The basement game of this week, Giants are hosting the Redskins there in the
basement
NFC East.
Game. Ooh,
oh, it's basement. This is the basement dweller. Do you see what London
some
Fletcher?
Some of us watched Giants film before this just so we'd be ready to talk about
it. Oh, there you go.
But I interrupted you because you're going to ask a much more interesting question.
Yeah, what do you think about London Fletcher? You see what he said this week?
About Jim Haslett?
Yeah. Here's the quote. I'll read it to you.
Okay.
He is a guy that does not know what he is doing, and the Washington Redskins and Jay Gruden in particular better watch his back and get Jim Haslett out of the door.
And then Haslett's son responded something like, I hate that you're trying to ruin my dad's career, something like that. And I think Fletcher tweeted back like, your dad has ruined plenty of people's careers.
Wow.
That makes me pause and stop and think a little bit, because I'm a Haslett defender and I go on DC radio all the time to defend Haslett. I don't call in to defend him, but when I'm on the show, I defend him because I know
you love calling into radio stations. That's your thing.
I love
you sit
call-ins
at home with your directory.
yep. But I know that the fans in DC are not happy with Haslett, and I like to go on to their stations and defend them to give them something else to think about, because Haslett's not a, I've never thought that he's a dope. I mean, he does a lot of stuff, and he might put guys in tough positions, but he'll also help guys overachieve because he does so many things out of his magic box of tricks and his, his scheme. London Fletcher, though, saying that makes me wonder, because Fletcher certainly knows Jim Haslett 10,000 times better than I do, and Fletcher's not a guy that's known for flying off the handle. So,
are you going to change your tune on DC Radio now? Are they going to new Andy Benoit?
I can only go off of what I see on the film and how I interpret it. And what Fletcher says doesn't have anything to do with the film, because I think there's a little bit of a personal relationship factor here in how Hazlitt's interacting with his players or whatever it might be. I will acknowledge this. I'll say to them what I just said to you, which is I wonder a little bit now, because Hazlitt rolls dice. And when you roll dice, you'd better have people liking you, because the dice are not always going to come up in your favor.
How do you see Hazlitt trying to contain the new dynamic wide receiver that is Odell Beckham Jr.?
That's a big concern, and the Giants need to – they're at their best when they get the ball in Beckham's hands quickly, early in games, and let him become a real focal point and a run-after-catch weapon. And I would hope they do that in this game. And for the Washington Redskins to defend that, they don't have the personnel to do it. Breland's played a lot better at cornerback for him, though, and even Amerson hasn't been as bad. That's the most I'm going to be – that's the furthest I'll go in complimenting that secondary. But they don't have the personnel that can match up to Beckham, so I would hope Hazlitt would roll some coverages and do something to double-team and make someone else beat him.
Beckham came in – did he miss the first three or four games?
You're asking me?
I think it was four. Yeah, now you get to look something up. Okay. What's amazing is that he's still only 100 yards back among rookie wide receivers for the leading receiving.
Is that true?
I think that's incredible.
Mike Evans is number one.
You know, I'm going to let you guess who two is.
Well, you said Beckham's only 100 back, so someone's ahead of Beckham still? Sammy Watkins?
Kelvin Benjamin.
Okay.
And then Beckham.
Yeah, because Watkins has been unproductive lately. Yeah, I could have. I didn't think that went through very much. Beckham missed the first five games.
Five. And now he's become...
Four.
There you go.
But he didn't start to fifth, and that's what I was thinking.
With
right?
Victor Cruz out, he's been the vocal point of that
offense. Yeah, oh yeah. No question, as he should be. And if all goes well, and by that I mean if he stays healthy, then he'll be the focal point of that offense for the next 8 years.
Jacksonville Jaguars on the road, Baltimore Ravens. The Ravens changing their tune a little bit here. Joe Flacco did not have a pass for greater than 20 yards through the air last week. This is the first time all season.
I didn't notice that watching the film.
Let's keep in mind, though, real quick, that the total offense was still 447 yards.
They were productive against Miami. And it was that's really odd, actually, that Flacco did not have 20 yards through the air. I heard the stat. I forgot about it, though, and I didn't notice it at all in the film. It's odd because that was a pass-first game that they had, and they ran the ball effectively on the final drive, the final touchdown drive. And so that boosted the run numbers, and deservedly so. They had some great run blocks, as they always do every week. But it was a passing game for them. And it's weird that they'd have a passing game and still not have one over 20 yards, because they had plenty of productive pass plays.
Is Joe Flacco best when you're not trying to force the deep ball and kind of methodically go down the field, or is he still always going to be that deep ball weapon?
That'll be his game. If the deep ball is his game, he's that kind of a passer. He sees the field that way. But he's also very good when he can go methodically down the field, which is why he works in Kubiak's system and why I think this will be a successful relationship for both in the long haul. I like Joe Flacco. I think you can do a lot of things with him. The other thing you can do with him that they have done in the system, and they did last week against Miami, is let him throw on the move a little bit.
Jets on the road this week visiting the Titans. Chris Johnson making the return to Tennessee. Tennessee ranks 27th in rushing. Johnson only has 558 yards for the Jets.
He should have never left. There was a place for him all along there.
Does Tennessee wish he stayed?
Well, they'd be right where they are now. I'm just saying it fits. I mean, they'd be ranked 27. They wouldn't be any worse off. Tennessee's running game is bad. And you know what? It starts with their offensive line, which is really concerning, because they signed Levitre for big money. They signed Michael Orr for relatively big money for a right tackle. He's been out the last few games, but they were bad. He's had a bad year with them, and mostly in pass protection, but they've been bad in the run game with him in there as well. Chance Warmack, first-round pick, has not gotten it yet, and at left tackle, Taylor Lewan, he's been pretty good, but he's starting to regress as, you know, in a rookie. He'll be okay, but he's having some rookie troubles at the end of his first season here. But that's two first-round picks, high first-round picks, and two big-time free agent signings, plus they drafted a center in the third round. And we're talking about an offensive line that cannot win in the run game right now.
So CJ Half-K wouldn't have done well in that system either.
Okay, you were just
like
I saw
that?
This.
That
you had this little look on
I
your
thought
face.
About it about 30 seconds ago.
I know,
I
and I wondered if I was saying something wrong because you had this look on your face.
When I get a grin, I got a pun on the way.
You think he'll
something.
Get a tattoo for that?
CJ Half-K?
Yeah, no, like on his
to,
ankle or
he
something?
He has to cross out 2K. And it's the half.
Oh, yeah, or just put a 1 above the 2.
There you go. Yeah, and a little
that fraction. Would take some real humility on his part. And from what I understand, he's not, you know, that's not no. something that he's overflowing with. Look, Chris Johnson, we know what he is now. I mean, he was – we've talked about his speed, and when you take the top off his speed and make him go from an A-plus speedster to A-minus even, or probably in this case B-plus, whatever it is, you know, he's a different back. He's not a threat at all anymore,
this
not
week,
in that regard.
This week, most of you probably noticed Cam Newton involved in that big car accident, rolled his truck a couple of times, still smiling somehow on the ground, and all of the photos from – whoever sent those.
Hey, Cam Newton, he knows to never stop smiling in public, man.
Or after an interception, he'll keep smiling. But if Cam Newton isn't able to play, he's listed as day-to-day
right
now.
Hold on. Wait a minute. Oh. After an interception. Well, we're nearing the end of the show, so
yeah,
we can kind of interrupt.
Cam Newton's always smiling, man.
Cam Newton is known. You're going to have to – I hate to do this. You're going to have to take this back because I'm going to make a great point.
Oh, here we go.
Cam Newton – this isn't a great point, but it's an obvious one. Cam Newton's known for sulking on the sidelines.
Yeah, well, and then when your team is 3-8-1 and you score a touchdown against the Saints, you're acting like you're on your way to the Super Bowl.
Or you're acting like the Saints can't touch you.
I don't dislike Cam Newton. I'm just saying.
I'm just saying, I guess the analyst in me is like by getting nerdy technical because he's not always smiling. He's known for as a pouter at times.
Yeah, I guess he was on the sideline a couple times with the towel over his head.
Yeah, and in press conferences, he's – wine and all that.
Well, good for Cam. We're happy Cam is okay. If Cam can't play, Derek Anderson comes into this
and he's
game.
Not playing. Cam's not playing this week. He can't. Yeah, he's not going to play with the back end.
Well, there you go. Derek Anderson.
Yeah.
Playoff hopes
Tampa
still
Bay,
alive.
Tampa Bay faced Derek Anderson in week one, and it worked out just fine for Carolina. So it's a big difference, though. I mean, I know that the Panthers are confident in Derek Anderson and all that kind of thing, and you should be in your backup QB. Let's hope you are. That's what good teams are, or also the Panthers are. But this is a big difference at QB because Cam Newton's legs are the key to that offense. I'm not going to say they're carrying the offense because other guys played well last week, but they were the key to that. They were the most important aspect of that game against New Orleans. And they've been the keys to a lot of games this year. And now you remove that element from the offense, so that changes your running game. And now you have to have more of a base rushing attack, which we haven't seen that this team and this offensive line is equipped to do. Pass protection, if you have a QB that can't move in there, you might want to get all five of your receiving options out in the patterns rather than just three guys like they did last week. But they did only three guys at times last week. Because they needed to help the pass protectors. They're not a great offensive line. And so it was good coaching. But I don't know if you can coach it the same way now. It's you're getting hamstrung, and that's what happens when you put in a number two QB.
We'll wrap up with our Monday night game. 2-5-8 teams, the Bears hosting the Saints. Mark Trestman's job is apparently safe there in Chicago. Should this be the case?
Yes. Yeah. Trestman has a great system. The players like him. It's just been a bad year. The defense is the problem in Chicago. The offense is totally underachieved. Totally. Don't get me wrong. Trestman would tell you that. I mean, I'm sure he's very disappointed. But that defense is the problem in Chicago. And I'm not so sure. I don't like to say coaches ought to be fired. I think it's time to move on from Mel Tucker because it's time to move on from the whole cover two zone based scheme. You can't do it. They don't begin to have the talent for it anymore anyway. I'd like to see them do what their division rivals have done in Minnesota and Detroit and bring in new defensive coordinators, new defensive schemes, and catch up to the modern age of football here.
A player on that offense for the Bears who used to be with the Saints offense is left tackle Jermon Bushrod. He went to the Pro Bowl in his last season with the Saints in 2012. How's he doing now, particularly in comparison with his replacement, Teron Armstead?
These aren't easy names, I know. Not every name's easy for everybody. He's doing it's like Gruden with
Roethlisberger.
Roethlisberger, yeah. I think it's been a good move for both teams. I think both teams have upgraded. Bushrod has not been as good this year as he was last. I thought last year was by far his best season, And I know that Aaron Kromer, his longtime O-line coach in both New Orleans and Chicago, felt that way as well. And he loves Bushrod. Work ethic's outstanding. The guy doesn't have very long arms, so they have to change some of his techniques and how he goes about blocking. But he has adjusted really well and he's become a patient guy who trusts his coaching. He's a good player, but he hasn't been quite as – I thought last year was very impressive. This year I think he's been fine. Armstead's more athletic than Bushrod, which is amazing because there might be only three or four left tackles in the league you can say that about. Bushrod moves extremely well on the perimeter. Armstead's the best pure perimeter run blocker in terms of athleticism in the game. It's 1 and 1A with him and Tyron Smith. So you get that element of it. But he's not a perfect left tackle for the Saints, and he might not. I know he left last week's game with an injury, and Harris did an okay job filling in against a bad Panthers D-line. I guess they get to go against a bad Bears D-line this week, though.
Yeah, what about the Saints' offense? Can we assume a big bounce-back game here against the Bears?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's in Chicago, I know, but I don't know how much that matters anymore.
Yeah, that hasn't seemed to matter.
Yeah, I mean, being in New Orleans hasn't helped them at all. They've been very bad at home at times, so there's no indication whatsoever that the Bears will be the better unit in this game. There's just, if you watch the way these teams play and the people they have to play with, and I know that's weird saying this the week after the Saints were horrendous against Carolina, but if you're putting money on this game, are you really comfortable putting money on the Bears defense against Drew Brees and Jimmy Graham?
No, hell no.
And I wouldn't be either. And I'm real concerned about how easy the Bears are to throw against. There's no pass rush, and they play a lot of soft zone. And I hate that combination. Everybody ought to hate that combination because it doesn't work. You can't do both. You can't have no pass rush and play soft zone.
And we'll see how the Saints and Teron Armstead do against the Bears. See, I got it out.
I admire you so much for going back to it. It sounds like you're ending the show with it.
I had an admission of guilt. It just felt bad. All right, guys, that's all we have for you this week. Remember to download the podcast and subscribe on iTunes. Just search MMQB Podcast and you'll show right there. From Andy, I'm John. We'll catch you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.